Hello, everybody. Welcome to the SoxProspects.com podcast. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for downloading or streaming. It's great to have you with us. My name is Chris Hatfield. I'm coming to you here from Sox Prospects South/Mid-Atlantic in our nation's capital. It's episode number 86 of the SoxProspects.com podcast. Joining me, as always, first of all, is Matthew... Joining me, as always, first off, is Matt Heagle. Hello, Matt.
Hey, Chris. Good to be on. How's it going?
Back from Lake Winnipesaukee over the weekend. How was your vacation?
That's right. It was good. It was got some sun, and it was nice for the first couple of days. So got a little colder here all of a sudden, but it was good to get up there before it got too cold.
That's good. Yeah, it got colder here today, too. It was kind of lame, but fall is coming. Also joining us, as always, is Ian Kundle. Hello, Ian.
Hi, Chris. How are we doing tonight?
And Ian, how are you doing? We should probably mention everybody, or unless you don't want to talk about it, but we should mention to everybody your medical update. Joining us despite being on the DL right now.
Yeah, I'm in a sling, and it's not the greatest thing, but it's better than it was a week ago, so we're improving.
Excellent. It's the shoulder cleanup went well. You've got some metal in you.
Yeah, rocking with the nice little screw in the shoulder, so that's good. But I guess that's what happens when you play baseball a lot growing up and have weird shoulders genetically or whatever. I don't know exactly how it worked out, but
yeah, that's weird.
Glad it's over with.
I'm scared to ever get my shoulder looked at because Lord knows whenever I play softball, I'm sore for like 3 days.
Don't, because you'll end up going from one thing to having like four things done.
Nice. All right. Well, as always, we thank you for downloading. If you could do us a favor, please subscribe, rate, and review on iTunes or on Stitcher. Any number of ways you can consume the podcast. Do you like listening to music on your smartphone? Do you like streaming on Pandora or on Spotify or any of those things? Well, if you download Stitcher, you can stream podcasts the same way. That's one way you can listen to the podcast. Of course, there's always going on iTunes, downloading it the old-fashioned way. Or if you want, you can just go to our news page. And on our news page, there's a little flash player there where you can stream the podcasts. That's another way to listen. But however you listen, we appreciate you being with us. As always, follow us on Twitter. You can follow the site's Twitter, at Sox Prospects. You can follow me, at SP Chris Hatfield. Matt, tell the people how they can follow you.
At Matt Heagle, H-U-E-G-E-L is my last name.
And Mr. Ian.
At Ian Kundall, I-A-N-C-U-N-D-A-L-L.
Excellent. And then, of course, we always love getting your listener emails, and that's going to be our first segment today. As always, remember, send your emails to podcast@soxprospects.com. Again, that's podcast@soxprospects.com. We always love hearing from you guys. We want to talk about what you want to hear about. So drop us an email. Let us know what you want to hear, what you're curious about. We like getting to questions. And then this is going to be our season in review show in two parts. This is part one. Episode number 86, like I mentioned. We're going to go over, in part one, we're going to go over the site All-Stars, postseason All-Stars, as voted on by the SoxProspects.com forum community. You can get to the forum from the Sox Prospects webpage. Join in the conversation. We love having more people join in. Some interesting stuff going on there. Great way to discuss, learn, debate more about the Red Sox farm system and all things Red Sox. We'll also have our picks for the postseason awards. That voting started today in categories such as Offensive Player of the Year, Pitcher of the Year, Rookie of the Year, Breakout of the Year, Comeback of the Year, so on and so forth. We're going to come up with our picks for those awards. We're going to discuss and debate those to close out part one. In part two, we're going to go our level-by-level recap of the season. We've kind of split the levels up amongst ourselves, and we are going to debate the stories of the season that happened at each level and kind of recap what went down. I should also mention that we are going to have our interview with Trey Ball at the end of the next episode, so that would be part two. And I was able to talk to Trey in Potomac, so we're going to have my interview with Trey Ball at the end of this episode as well. But without further ado, like I said, podcast@soxprospects.com is our email. If you want to send us an email, have something answered, and we've got a great batch of questions. So let's jump right into it, fellas. Our first question comes from frequent emailer Mike in D.C., and Mike says, fellas, my question is this. Do you think front offices have changed how they view the timeline for young prospects within the system? It seems like young prospects with legit talent blow through the system these days. Mookie Betts went from a struggling second baseman in low A to being a key part of the Sox outfield in like 14 months. Xander Bogaerts went from an intriguing 17-year-old in the DSL to the starting shortstop in the World Series in 3 years. Technically third baseman, but same difference. Not trying to put undue pressure on the kids in Greenville, but do you think the Sox FO may be thinking of one or more of these kids as ready to help Boston as early as 2017? And does that thought process have an impact on decisions made this offseason? I feel like traditionally the timeline would have been more like 3 or 4 years for kids that young and that far away. So a lot to digest there, but I think what it boils down to here is this, guys. Is the Sox front office fast-tracking guys more so now than they used to in the past? And that's part one of it. And part two, I think, is what guys in Greenville could move quickly versus not moving as quickly. So maybe we'll take the first part. I guess, Matt, guys moving more quickly than before. What are your thoughts on that? Agree or disagree with Mike's analysis?
I don't disagree that. I mean, those guys did move more quickly. I think they sort of showed that they could, and they showed the talent. I think there were some people in the past that have moved fairly quickly. Ellsbury comes to mind. These guys were particularly young, Xander and Betts. I kind of just think they ended up being sort of those freak prospects that were able to handle it. And I guess maybe the front office was a little better at recognizing that than in the past, and just moving them when they were proving that they'd handled the level. I mean, I think another point to mention is that it's not the same front office as as has been making these decisions. So we'll definitely have to sort of see if those things change in this upcoming year, and how Dave Dombrowski's opinions end up affecting that. But for the most part, I kind of feel like those are a couple of specific examples of very high-level prospects. So I don't think the philosophy has changed that much, but I think there has been some eye-opening prospects around the league, such as, the Mike Trouts, guys like that. I don't know, Carlos Correa comes to mind, but that was a little later, obviously. Bryce Harper, yeah, exactly. So I think it's sort of more of a realization that it's not impossible that the guys that young can contribute. So there's no reason you have to hold them down, but it takes a sort of special prospect, and I don't think it changes anything for the sort of run-of-the-mill or more normal arc of prospects or in young players coming up.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, Ian?
Yeah, I think those two guys are more the exception than the rule. They're both... they're both exceptional talents. They're not the type of prospects you see coming through the system that often, ceiling wise, though it seems like they are doing a little bit. They've been getting a few of those guys more frequently now, but I don't think it's just kind of, as Matt said, alluded to, it's one of those things where those guys they pretty much had the total package, in that they all of a sudden they were eventually performing at the level. They had both were very advanced, even though they were young, they were both had very advanced both profiles, and they had the maturity and work ethic to be able to handle an aggressive assignment even at a young age. And I kind of think it was just the perfect storm of things coming together that just pushed them up the system that quickly. And so I don't think it's something where it's necessarily that front office was deliberately trying to fast track them. It was more their hand kind of got forced by how good they performed and what they, the reports they were getting from the roving instructors and the front office guys who were going out and seeing them and the coaching staff, et cetera, were coming back. And it's just like, there's a point where if a guy's not being challenged, you have to push them up. Doesn't matter how young they are. I think we kind of saw that this year with Anderson Espinosa, where, in a normal year, I'm not sure that he leaves the GCL, but they reached the end of the season and it was just, he was way too good. So instead of sending him to Lowell, which they normally would do, they said, let's just send him to Greenville because this is where he's going to be next year. Mm-hmm. Let's give him a taste. And it's kind of like, yeah, that, you know, it's both a reward and a showing that we need to challenge these people eventually. You know, it doesn't do anyone any good to leave them at a level all season that they're demolishing. You need to give them a challenge. And a lot of the time, prospects need to fail or taste failure in order to, you know, just make the necessary adjustments and improve as a player. Mm-hmm. And so, and often to do that, you need to be promoted to an advanced level. So yeah. I think it was just, yeah, kind of the perfect storm of things coming together.
Yeah, and I don't think it's necessarily true either that they haven't fast-tracked guys in the past. Let me throw a couple names at you. Abe Alvarez made his Major League debut the season after being drafted. It just, you don't remember him because he flamed out.
Clay Meredith?
Yeah, Clay Meredith, fast-tracked. The Red Sox in 2004.
Craig Hansen.
The Red Sox in 2004 drafted a shortstop out of Arizona State that made his debut in 2006 and would have been sooner if he wasn't injured in Pawtucket, and that's, of course, Dustin Pedroia. So, you know, and Matt, like Matt said, Jacoby Ellsbury, you know, they didn't quite strap the rocket to him that guys like Betts and them had, but I think the thing is, it maybe seems like they shot through the system quicker than they maybe did. Don't forget, Mookie Betts spent the season after he was drafted in Lowell. Right. I mean, it wasn't like he, you know, went to Lowell the season he was drafted. He was drafted in 2011 and he spent 2012 in Lowell and 2013 was in Greenville. So, you know, that's behind where guys like Michael Chavis this year was, you know, things like that. Xander Bogaerts, you know, he played in the DSL for a season and he was in the DSL the whole season. So that's, you know, Rafael Devers only spent half a season in the DSL. Wendell Rijo skipped the DSL. You know, so these guys didn't necessarily immediately have the rocket strapped to their back. They just, well, you know, played their way through levels.
Yeah, and with Bogaerts, too, you got to remember that he was going to go to Lowell. He wasn't going to Greenville in that. What year was that? 2012?
Right? Yeah, it would have been 2011.
He was going to Lowell. Like, Lowell was prepared for him to be their starting shortstop. And a couple days before the season started, I think it was Jose Garcia got hurt in Greenville, and they needed a shortstop, and so they just bumped into Greenville, and he stuck there. So even there, that was kind of something that they kind of fluked into. If that injury doesn't happen, he stays in Lowell that whole season, probably.
Is that true?
So, yeah.
Interesting.
I know that for a fact. So, yeah, that is true.
Because I'm looking at Greenville. Interesting. All right.
I'm not sure it was Jose Garcia, but it was whoever the shortstop was in Greenville got hurt, and that's why he went to Greenville. He wasn't originally going to Greenville.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that makes sense because, yeah, Bogaerts was promoted to Greenville.
Because he started extended.
Bogaerts was promoted from Greenville to extended on June 9th, and Jose Garcia was sent from Greenville to Lowell on June 16th. So I don't think it was even... Was it that he got hurt, or did he just not
No, he got hurt. I'm pretty sure he got hurt, or...
Because in Greenville, he was hitting 219, 265, 335, and just in over his head. So either way, whatever. But that's interesting.
But yeah, no, because like Lowell had a nameplate ready for Bogaerts. That's how sure they were getting him. And then, obviously, yeah.
Interesting. All right, so. Well, cool. Dropping some knowledge. But anyway, oh, and as far as, I guess, just really quick, in terms of the players in Greenville who might move quickly, to me, obviously, Andrew Benintendi and Yoan Moncada are the names that come to mind. I'd be stunned if Benintendi didn't at least finish next year in Portland. And
he should start next year in Portland. I'm going to say
he could start. Yeah, no, I agree.
He should. I'm saying he should. He should. I mean, having seen him this year, he's not going to be challenged in Salem, and it's kind of. I mean, I guess he definitely will start there. Or I shouldn't say definitely because actually, you know, new front office, we don't know for sure, but. He likely will start there, but it's going to be Travis Eskin that it's a very short time there, I think.
Right. Yeah, I think he starts there. I think he spends even less time there than Travis did.
Yeah.
Okay, so there's those two, and I think the other guys will move slowly. I don't know what you guys think. Maybe Devers if he's absolutely tearing the cover off the ball, but I think everybody else, it's a level a year.
Yeah, especially I think Devers, he'll get held back by his defense, and he's just, yeah. Raw and Garrett at the plate. I mean, if you wanted to rush him, you could, because defensively he could probably handle it, but he's the one who needs the most work with his bat, so I wouldn't push him at all.
Yeah. Anybody we're missing, Matt, or does that sound right to you?
No, that sounds about right. Like you said, they really can't. I can't envision any of the other guys moving too quickly. Devers is the only question mark I'd have, but he's so young that I think he'll probably take it fairly slowly as well, or at least not super quickly.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Well, thanks for the question, Mike. We appreciate it. Next question is from David. David says, if you could convert one Sox minor league position player into a pitcher and one pitcher into a position player, who would they be? It's your choice if you want to pick a player who has struggled in run role and may do well in the other, a la Williams-Jerez, or someone who has shown interest in a different track, Casey Kelly. I don't know if any of those guys exist. Or if there's just someone you'd be intrigued to see take one of their tools in a different direction, like seeing Javier Guerra let loose his cannon on the mound, which is intriguing. In case you were wondering, this question is not trolling you for you to call out Trey Ball. Thanks, David. It's an interesting question. It's admittedly one that I wish I had given a little more thought to before coming on the podcast. But one position player that you wish you could move positions. Does anyone come to mind for you guys immediately? Feel free to blurt it out.
Well, are we saying move position or move to pitcher? Because that was his question was move, turn into a pitcher.
That's okay. I'm sorry. I said it wrong. That's what I meant.
Sorry. Well, okay. Sorry. I just wanted clarification.
Yeah, that's fine. It's either pitcher into position player or position player into pitcher. But yeah. I mean, Guerra as a pitcher would be nice. Apparently Longy used to hit in the 90s. Right?
Yeah. Yes, that's correct.
In the majors now, but I'd love to see Jackie Bradley Jr.
That's a good one, too. Mound.
Interesting.
Real interesting.
I would also say catchers.
Yeah.
Right.
Christian
I'd like
Vasquez,
to see. I'd like to see Brian Johnson hit. Because you forget, he was DH for Florida.
Yeah, DH.
And he was like a good
first
hitter
base,
there, so.
I think. Like he played first base, actually.
But I think he was their three hitter. I'm pretty sure he's one of their better hitters.
He won the Olerud Award, right?
He won the John Olerud Award
as the best two-way player. No, I know he did. You don't have to look it up. Don't worry.
Okay. I think he'd be pretty interesting.
Just for shiggles, how about Max Watt as a hitter? For those who don't know, Max Watt was a guy they drafted and signed this year who is 6'8", 250. I think that would be some fun, create a player type stuff. Although I guess he is on the mound too, but, seeing Max Watt hit would be interesting from a different sort of perspective. As far
as kind of like you stick, I was going to say you stick like Matty Johnson on the mound, nice little 5'6", 180 pounds center fielder.
Yoey Lancerci. That's what he is. Yoey Lancerci.
Oh, really?
Is Matty,
is that
Matty
how big
Johnson.
He is?
He's Matty Johnson at Jace. Yeah. Who else? I can't think of any other pitchers who I'd like to see hit, mostly because it's not really something.
Cozart was an outfielder when he came to Duke.
Okay, yeah, that's interesting.
Jay Cozart was.
That's interesting.
I'm trying to think of. I'm just going down the draft list right now to see if there's anyone else.
I'm just going down the org page. Yeah.
I don't know. Kevin Steen's supposed to be a real good athlete, right?
Yeah, that'd be interesting.
Basketball player.
Yeah, Jalen Williams was a football player, although football players hitting has been kind of hit or miss in the system.
Shaq.
Get it? Hit
wasn't
or miss.
He like second round pick this year? Yeah, that was a good one.
He's first round.
Wasn't I think he, it was a first.
Was he a first round pick?
I think he was late good first. He's on Carolina, I believe.
Yeah.
I still love that when you Google Shaq Green Thompson, at least for me, when I Google Shaq Thompson, the first thing that comes up is his baseball reference page. But that's probably keyed to my, he went 25th overall, Shaq Thompson.
There you go. I think that's because he has one of the most intriguing minor league stat lines of all time.
Probably. That's true. Interesting question, David. We appreciate it. But that's kind of it's one of those things you'd have to like go see a team, really, I think, to be able to say that and be looking at the guys in the field as they're playing. Our next question comes from Lendl, and Lendl says, do you guys think Moncada can be the right fielder of the future for the Red Sox? With Pedroia and Sandoval signed to long-term deals, it seems he'll be blocked at those two spots. Plus, with Betts already showing great defensive ability in center and not thinking of JBJ as more of a fourth outfielder, debatable, I think the best spot for Moncada is in right. His speed and arm should be a good combo out there. Moncada is interesting to me, guys, where part of me wants to say it's too early to think of that, and part of me wants to say, well, if you're going to teach him an entirely new freaking position, he's going to have to learn it at some point. The thing that I wonder about is how much the front office is going to change over with the new Dombrowski regime. There's a possibility it doesn't change much at all. There's a possibility if they promote, you know, Mike Hazen into GM and everybody else stays in place, there's a possibility that they hire a new GM and there's a whole bunch of changes. So who knows? That evaluation may happen now, may happen a year from now. I know we've talked about what his tools could be, but I guess just really quick, where do you guys see him maybe fitting down the road, or is it just really too early to tell?
I think it's too early to tell. I would let him stay at second base for now because that's clearly where he is most comfortable. And I think that's kind of what should be the priority for now. But I think actually his long-term position is probably third base, because I think in a couple years, both in terms of, I think his defensive tool set or skills would play there well. He's got the build of a third baseman more than a second baseman. And in a couple of years after Ortiz retires, I could see Sandoval transitioning to designated hitter, and that would open up third base for him. And he's ahead of Devers in terms of development wise. I think he's going to move quicker, so I could see where he ends up.
Yeah, for me, I mean, it's just too early. I mean, you can go through all the different sort of permutations or whatever, you know. I mean, they have filled out outfield right now, it seems like, with, I mean, you know, it's a lot of people think that Jackie Bradley is going to be the starter and are looking forward to seeing him in that role next year. So the fourth outfielder characterization is a little too quick on that, I think. But I mean, it's, you know, it's a possibility, but then you have Margot coming up too. So, I mean, they have depth in that area too. And like Ian said, Sandoval is a question mark as a long-term third baseman, so it, you know, could fit there too. But it's just all these different questions. I just don't feel like it's worth thinking about too much at this point. And just if they think there's a possibility, and he looks, you know, like he has the tools for second, and he's comfortable there, keep him there for now, and then figure it out. Either, you know, I'm thinking probably going into 2017 is when you really want to think about that sort of thing.
Yeah, and the thing to me, too, is never mind what position he's going to play in the major leagues, but I want to see what they're going to do with all these guys in the infield and A-ball. You know, if Moncada and Wendell Rijo are on the same roster, where are you playing them both? Is it, you know, one guy's DHing every other day? You know, it's you've got the two third basemen, you've got a shortstop. We'll see how that shakes down. But thanks for the question, Lindell. Our next question comes from RSGIL00 at a domain name who didn't leave their name. And that person asks, why haven't / can't the Red Sox produce any arms for the bullpen? Do the Red Sox spend any time teaching pitchers the splitter, or does that fall on the pitchers themselves? Hembree would be devastating with the splitter. So there's a number of things in here, I guess. First off, I guess I disagree with why haven't they produced any arms for the bullpen. Jonathan Papelbon and Junichi Tozawa come to mind. Granted, they're not a bullpen arm factory, but at any rate, I think that, like we've talked about in the past, how they really have changed their outlook in terms of developing bullpen arms, I think. And I think we've talked about how there's plenty of interesting arms in AAA in the bullpen. So I think that's kind of changing. Does that seem to be the case to you guys as well? And is it a matter of philosophy, or is it part of it just a matter of having the arms coming up? Because they've had problems producing pitchers in general, I think, as a general proposition, not just bullpen arms. Matt?
Yeah, I mean, it seems like a lot of the pitchers they've had come up recently haven't really ended up performing. Like, a lot of them have come up in starting roles, and it's like, if they're not quite starters, they're probably good bullpen arms. Like, guys like Michael Bowden and Alex Wilson and Kyle Weiland, guys like that come to mind as guys that didn't, but Alex Wilson ended up making the transition to bullpen this year with the Tigers, so they sort of cut bait on him a little bit early. So that could be one guy you throw in that mix as a guy they produced. Like you said, it does seem like they've changed their philosophy a little bit to move these guys quicker and maybe the double A level more to the bullpen if that's what their ultimate future looks like. But yeah, I mean, they've been developing a lot more pitchers recently than in like this, you know, the last year or so than they have in the last few years before that. So now it does seem like they have a good mix of bullpen arms in the high minors that they could contribute. That you started to see this year, like with Noe Ramirez and Jonathan Aro, and you know guys like Diane Diaz and Pat Light. So they've got some guys in the pipeline now. It just seems like there's a little bit of a lull producing pitchers in general with the system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean part of it too is you know the bullpen arm as a commodity is just so fungible. I mean, don't forget. I remember a time when the Red Sox had produced future setup man Manny Del Carmen, and that just kind of didn't happen suddenly. And you know we see guys just fall off the map entirely randomly. 4 years into what looks like it's going to be a promising career, or vice versa, after 3 or 4 years, it just clicks on their fourth team. So I think part of that is just the nature and volatility of bullpen arms. Ian, you got anything else to toss in on the bullpen question?
Not really, just based on your point, what you were just talking about. I mean, you look at Ryan Cook, who they picked up, I think, in a waiver claim, because he was DFA'd by Oakland. He was an all-star 2 years ago out of the bullpen.
Yeah.
And yeah. Now he can't get anyone out for the Red Sox in September and hasn't been able to get anyone out all year. So, you know, as you said, I think it's just bullpen arms are very fungible. I will say, though, that I was talking with some evaluators this year about the Red Sox pitching depth. And one thing I noticed is they just don't have a lot of hard throwers. You see some orgs. What prompted this was watching the Staten Island Yankees run out 3 straight pitchers sitting like 97 to 99 right. In a game this year. And they were all a couple like lanky Dominican kids with big arms, and the Red Sox just don't really. I don't know, for whatever it is. This is for the last couple of years. They haven't really developed those hard throwers, and we're seeing you know where out of the bullpen velocity tends to play if you can throw it for strikes, and they just don't really. They don't develop those type of guys. It's more the guys who are, you know, sitting low 90s or maybe in touching the mid 90s. So I don't know if that's something that I could see it changing with Dombrowski on board, because that's his MO, is he wants hard throwing righties for the most part. It seems at least that was his track record when he was with the Tigers, is they just like take hard throwing pitchers, and if they're not starters, so be it. I'm interested to see how that changes, but I think that's also played a part of them not having developing, you know, as you said, they've developed a few, but not that many.
Yeah. Yeah, and as far as the developing new pitches thing, I think it's a combination of the player and the pitching coach deciding what might work for that pitcher. But, you know, it's not like the Red Sox go to their players in spring training and say, okay, who wants to learn a splitter or anything like that. And I think assuming a pitcher can learn a pitch is also, you know, not necessarily something that's a good idea. I'm not really sure what else to say on that point, but
there's a reason not very, very few pitchers throw the splitter. Mm-hmm. It's a very hard pitch to throw. You know, it requires, you need really long fingers to be able to do it. Just, it's not a pitch that as you said, you can go up to anyone and be like, hey, do you want to throw a splitter this year?
Right.
So.
Right. Cool. Well, thanks for the question. Our next question is from Greg, and Greg says, lately, it seems like the Sox number one prospect hasn't been able to enjoy it long. Since Bogaerts graduated, Betts, Swihart, Rodriguez, and Moncada have all had the spot. This is a true story. And it seems like everyone who lost the spot did so because they graduated to the majors. That is true in all but the case of Rafael Devers, who he did not list on there. But that was more Moncada jumping ahead than Devers falling back, we should mention, ad nauseum, frankly. Have the Sox ever seen anything like that before? I guess my answer would be I haven't, at least since the site started in 2003, I haven't seen the number one prospect change as often as it has in the past couple of years. But again, it's been kind of a perfect storm where they've had guys who've moved very quickly. You know, it looks like, You know, what happens is when you have a situation like, for example, when Hanley Ramirez was the top prospect in the system when he was an A-ball and he was still going to be in the system for three more years, you have the same number one prospect for 3 years. When you have a guy who rockets through the system who's your number one prospect and is going to graduate, you get another one in there. And it's been kind of a perfect storm this year, as we'll talk about when we discuss the Pawtucket Red Sox season in the season wrap-up part two. I don't really know what else to really add here. Guys, but if either of you have some thoughts on this, like I said, I think it's just kind of coincidental more than anything.
Yeah, I mean, it just shows the sort of talent they have at the top levels of their system now, and that, you know, that the top prospect has been in Pawtucket and at the top levels recently, so that's a good sign for the immediate future and sort of immediate long-term future of the big league club. I can't remember that many graduating like that. So that's, I think it's a good sign for the club.
Right. All right, cool. Well, that's our that is our listener email portion of the podcast. Again, podcast@soxprospects.com. If you guys have any questions, make sure you send them in. We appreciate it. If it's something that we've already hit on a previous podcast, I will usually just reply and say, hey, we talked about that a couple episodes ago. Here was the answer to that. Go check it out if you want to hear more discussion. But we appreciate, as always, we appreciate your emails, and make sure you send them in. I guess moving on to the Sox Prospects All-Stars. This was published, when did this go up, Matt? 2 days ago or yesterday? 2 days ago. 3 days ago. The 18th. What was that? Friday. Went up last Friday as voted on by the SoxProspects.com community. We had our position-by-position All-Stars, and I guess we just wanted to touch on them very briefly. There's really not a whole lot of discussion to be had here, we kind of realized before the show. But the list of All-Stars going around the diamond, I guess, starting with the hitters, at catcher was Jordan Procession, who spent the year between Greenville and Salem. And Procession really had more of a strong defensive year. He hit very well in the first half, was named a South Atlantic League All-Star, and didn't hit quite as well in Salem. At first base is Sam Travis. Travis split the year between Salem and Portland and was one of the top offensive players in the system this year. We'll talk a little bit more about him when we talk about the Offensive Player of the Year award. I think he's a nominee there. Second base, of course, Yoan Moncada, who spent most of his season with Greenville, although he did spend about 6 weeks, I think, before that in extended spring training after signing in February with the club to much fanfare for a $3.1 million signing bonus, which the Red Sox had to pay $100% tax on. $100 tax would have been nice, but
$31 million.
Yeah, $31.5 million tax on that, too. Did I not say that as the signing bonus?
You said $3.1
million. Oh, $31.5 million, sorry. Wow. Sorry about that. Anywho, third base was his teammate in Greenville, Rafael Devers. And actually, I'll just mention now as well, the shortstop was also Greenville's Javier Guerra. We'll talk about the Greenville infield in part two a little bit more. But that was a loaded infield. Both of those guys really impressed with the bat as well as in the field in different ways. Devers for just kind of being precocious despite his age. Guerra for being able to hit period, which no one really kind of realized he could do while playing unreal defense at shortstop. The three outfielders were Andrew Benintendi, the number 7 pick overall this year, split his half season between Lowell and Greenville, hitting very well in both spots. Jackie Bradley Jr., who really revived his career this year. He was named to the team, voted onto the team, or voted an all-star, whatever the phrasing would be, on his body of work in Pawtucket, never mind what he's done in Boston, although you would think that's at least in the back of everyone's mind who's voting. But in Pawtucket, he ranked 3rd in the International League in on-base percentage and 2nd in slugging. He had a really great year at the plate in Pawtucket, in addition to playing his usual great defense. And also Manuel Margot was the 3rd outfielder. He split his year between Salem and Portland, like Sam Travis did. Strong defense in center field, hit very well in Salem to start the year, had that long streak of 69 plate appearances before striking out for the first time to start the year. He was the last player in the minor leagues to strike out. Struggled a little bit in Portland, but did end the season hot. And he was also, I think, the 2nd youngest player in the Eastern League for the time he was there, at least when he was first promoted, he was. I'm not sure if that was still the case at the end of the year. Switching to the mound, the starting pitchers. Two of the starting pitchers were in from Pawtucket, and that was Brian Johnson and Henry Owens, the two left-handers. We've talked plenty about them, really not much more to say. Granted, not exactly stellar statistical seasons, but as far as starting pitchers, and maybe we could talk about this a little bit, not really a strong season statistically for guys, at least in the full season levels. That said, in short season, where our other two starting pitcher all-stars came from, were right-hander Anderson Espinoza, the Venezuelan who pitched in the Dominican Summer League, Gulf Coast League, and got one start in Greenville. Just an unreal season for him as a 17-year-old. He would be entering the draft next year if he were a high schooler and from the United States. As well as another 17-year-old right-hander out of Nicaragua, and Roniel Raudes, who started the year in the DSL, was there for a little longer than Espinoza, but then got called up to the Gulf Coast League, pitched great there too. He didn't get called up to Lowell, did he? No, it was just Lakens and Allen and Pimentel, I'm thinking of.
No, he didn't.
And DeJesus. No. So, those are your starters. And then finally, the relief pitchers. First off was Williams Harris, the 2011 second-round pick as an outfielder, converted to pitching last year and has taken just wonderfully to the mound. Moved all the way up from Greenville to Portland over the course of the season. Looks like a guy they might be fast-tracking, and he's a guy that when we talk about the Rule 5 draft later this offseason, he, I think, has to be protected this offseason if they don't want to lose him in Rule 5, so that'll be interesting. Heath Hembree, the aforementioned Heath Hembree, had a very good year in Pawtucket. He, the 26-year-old, he had a 1.04 whip. I was trying to see how many saves he had, but he was their closer. Made the trip up and down 995 a couple times. Probably going to be fighting for a spot in the bullpen next year, but who the heck knows what they're going to do with that in Boston. And finally, Jonathan Aureau, another guy who blew through the system. Started the year in Portland and got promoted to Pawtucket, but really you have to look at it as he started last year in Greenville. And this year made his major league debut. So Jonathan Aureau, really an impressive rise through the system over the past couple of years. And those are your all-stars. Gentlemen, I guess to start, were there any positions at which you thought, you know, maybe there was another deserving player, not necessarily at the expense of someone who's in there, but someone who probably could have been slipped in there? I guess starting with Matt.
Well, the one that comes to mind, or at least when I was looking at it beforehand, was on the starting pitchers. Aaron Wilkerson really had a great season. Yep. He's not a prospect. He is a prospect in some ways, but he's not a high level, well known prospect, young prospect type. But, I think he's a 26-year-old former indie leaguer. But he really showed some stuff at Salem and had even better numbers at Portland. And I think his final numbers really were deserving of one of those top four spots. Like, if you look at him versus Henry Owens, it seems pretty clear that he had a better season, statistically at least. And, he's sort of a command control type guy, but for the most part, it's gotten pretty good reviews. So I don't know if he's really a major leaguer, but maybe at least a triple-A type guy next season. And he just had a really nice season overall. I think he was deserving.
I would have said I agreed on Wilkerson. I think that maybe you could make a case for Marco Hernandez at shortstop. Guerra hit well, but he was pretty streaky. He had some, and then I think it was you were pointing this out to me that he really went downhill in the second half, seemed to tire out, and just his second half line wasn't as good as his first half line. And you look at Hernandez. I'm trying to bring up his full stats, sorry. Hernandez ended up putting up a combined line of 305, 330, 454 between Pawtucket and Portland. So he had a better slash line than Guerra did, and he didn't show as much power, but he showed it in the high minors. So the big difference is, though, Guerra is much better defensively than Hernandez, so I think that more than makes up for it. But I think you could make a case that Hernandez deserves some recognition at shortstop or some sort of, if we had an infield utility position, I think he would have got that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's fair. It's kind of funny because there were guys who maybe in midseason may have gotten more more consideration. Mauricio Dubon is a guy that comes to mind as maybe might have gotten a little more consideration mid-season, but when he got promoted to Salem, which was a really aggressive assignment for him, that was really challenging for him to succeed statistically, which, as we know, is not necessarily the be-all, end-all. Another guy, I'll mention another starting pitcher, another couple. Michael Kopech was a guy who had a pretty good season. Kopech, you know, struck out more than a batter an inning. The walks were a little high, admittedly, and I think the fact that he was suspended for performance enhancing, for the, I shouldn't say performance enhancing drugs, even though I guess technically it was, but violating the minor league drug policy. I think that kind of hurt him a little bit too, but statistically he had a pretty good year, and I think he didn't necessarily deserve to be voted in based on the sample size, but Logan Allen in 24 innings had a stellar line, 1.11 ERA, a whip of 0.78, more than a strikeout per inning, and less than a walk per nine innings, 0.4 walks per nine innings to be exact, so that's less than a walk per 18 innings, actually. So those guys were probably worthy of some sort of recognition, although I agree with the guys that maybe got voted in, with the exception of, I think, Wilkerson probably is a guy that could have gotten voted in. On the mound, I guess, as far as, you know, Hembry had a good statistical season, but I think some other guys, Ian Corey Pimentel, Chandler Shepard, come to mind as guys that maybe statistically could have had an argument. Diane Diaz and Pat Light were all kind of that morass of maybes on the relievers. So I think that kind of covers most of them, but good job, I guess, by our voters. It was, I think, a pretty easy season. The only tight races were a catcher, which was between Procession and Portland's Tim Roberson, which, had we had a DH on this year's All-Stars, I think Roberson would have won that. I think the difference to me was Procession's defense was a lot better, whereas Roberson hit a little better in Double A. And that fourth starting pitcher spot between Owens and the guys we had mentioned already. So that's the All-Star voting. Not really a lot to talk about there, like I said, but where there is a lot to talk about is our season-end awards voting, which is happening right now on the forums. So if you're not a member, sign up, become a member, and you can come in and vote. And I guess we're going to go around really quick and talk about our picks for those awards. Where should we start with the big ones and work our way down, or should we start with the lower ones and work our way up, fellas? Thinking maybe the latter. Does that make sense?
Yeah, you work our way up. Let's keep the audience on their heels.
Okay, well, let's start then with the Dominican Summer League Player of the Year, which this one's always tough for me because you're kind of comparing apples and oranges with pitchers to hitters and things like that, but the seven nominees are outfielder Lorenzo Cedrola, outfielder Juan Hernandez, catcher / first baseman Eddie Reynoso, and then four pitchers, three of them starters in Victor Garcia, Roniel Raudes, and Denny Reyes, and relief pitcher Victor Diaz. Kind of a tough one, especially where if you're, to me, I guess, I can go first if you guys want, unless one of you wants to volunteer. But to me, it's considering what the level is in the Dominican Summer League, it's not necessarily as easy as picking the best stats. Either of you want to take it? Matt, do you want to jump in, or should I just run with it?
Well, I can give my pick. I mean, like you said, it's really tough. Like, you know, different guys have different reasons to like them, and we don't have as much scouting information. So,
right.
You know, I tend to ignore the ERA a little bit, and Roniel Raudes seems like the obvious pick for me. It's, you know, the spectacular whip at 0.91, the strikeout to walk ratio and strikeout to innings pitched ratio. It's just insane. So that's the pick for me. All these numbers are so good for different reasons, though, and it's just hard to really sort through them. So you could really go for any of them, I feel like.
Yeah, I should mention that the strikeout, it's 63 strikeouts to 3 walks, which is crazy, in 53 and 2/3 innings, which is kind of hilarious because Denny Reyes also had 63 strikeouts and 3 walks, but that was in 75 innings, so a little different. Ian, who was your pick?
I also would have was going with Raudius. Or how do we pronounce it? Do we know? Probably not.
You can find that out in Instructs.
Yeah, I will find that out. We'll go Raudace. I would go with him also for
Sorry, my email just dinged. But for the reason that Matt mentioned, you can't really make a lot of stats in the DSL or scoring decisions. But I think it says that of all the guys listed there, he was the one who was promoted to the GCL. Mm-hmm. So I think they also, that means they think the highest, or they think some, there's something there. So I think that had some weight with when I made my decision.
And we should mention, he was promoted to the GCL, but he got 53 innings in the DSL, which is why he's in there. Anderson Espinoza, I think, only had like 20 innings in the DSL. That's why we didn't nominate him. But yeah, with Espinoza, it seemed clear that the plan was to promote him to the Gulf Coast League once the Gulf Coast League started, whereas with Raudes, it seemed like he kind of forced the promotion by being too good. I'm not playing devil's advocate when I say I almost picked Raudes, but I actually picked outfielder Lorenzo Cedrola. He was by far the best hitter on the two Dominican Summer League teams. In 67 games, he hit .321, .420, .415, one home run, and 27 stolen bases. One thing that you see a lot of in the Dominican Summer League, especially with the Red Sox teams, is their on-base percentages are very high. You don't see a lot of slugging, and you don't see necessarily guys hitting for high averages. And also Cedrola did it at a younger age. I think Juan Hernandez, who was also nominated, he was nominated, but this is his age 19 season. Whereas Cedrola, who played center field for DSL Red Sox 2, this was his age 17 season. So, much more age appropriate. He's going to be at the Fall Instructional League where Ian's going to get to check him out. And I think, the Red Sox pitching at that level was so good. I'm curious as to how much of that was just the hitters they were all facing, because it seemed like, you could have put any number of pitchers on this list in addition to the ones we had there. We mentioned that Anderson Espinoza started the year great. Some other guys who really played well, who really pitched well, were Darwin's and Hernandez. Christopher Acosta, when he came back from his injury, he missed about, I think, 3 or 4 weeks with an injury. But when he came back, he pitched very well. Junior Espinoza, a right-hander who was on DSL Red Sox 1, pitched well. There were guys who had outings where they pitched great and outings where they then would come back and not pitch as well. But a lot of great pitchers down there, not so many hitters. That's why I actually go Cedrola. Moving on, we'll go with let's go up to the majors. First off, we'll go with our ex-prospect of the year. That is a former Red Sox player who came up through the Red Sox farm system, or at least some of the way, and is now in the major league. I guess it doesn't have to be in the major leagues, but this year it was all major leaguers because we found 6 major leaguers, although I think Frankie Montas got some consideration. Let's just maybe really quick just say, let's put it this way. Did anyone not pick Anthony Rizzo? Who seems a pretty obvious choice.
Yeah, no, it's Rizzo.
Rizzo is one of the best players in the major leagues right now. And as of Saturday, his line was .282, .391, .526 with 30 home runs and 17 stolen bases, which I didn't realize, in 147 games. The other nominees were Jose Iglesias of the Tigers, Josh Reddick of the Athletics, John Lester of the Cubs, Jonathan Papelbon of the Phillies and Nationals, and Alex Wilson, of the previously mentioned, of the Tigers. It seems like this might be a category that Anthony Rizzo is going to have a stranglehold on for the foreseeable future. Probably not much more to say there, right, guys?
No, I guess Papelbon might be my second, but that's Rizzo's the obvious one there.
Yeah,
Rizzo's one of the top 10 players in all of baseball. So
yes, yep. We added a new category, homegrown player of the year this year, and it has nothing to do with the state of Colorado. What it is a player who graduated as a prospect in a prior season but is still in the organization. So the nominees were Mookie Betts, Xander Bogaerts, Jackie Bradley, Brock Holt, and Dustin Pedroia, and this is on their full body of work. Gentlemen, it seems to me it was a 2-man race. Ian, who did you pick?
This is just tough, and I actually went, I did vote on the Meta Forum, and I went against what the majority has right now, and I went with Xander Bogaerts. And the main reason I did this was his defense has improved to a level that I honestly never thought it would reach. I thought he would be passable at shortstop. I didn't think he would be someone who would actually save runs for them at shortstop. And he's really turned himself into a solid average to plus defensive shortstop, and having that type of defensive profile and being, I think he's has the highest average of any shortstop. He's hitting 321, 352, 420 on the year. I think the home runs are going to come, and I just think that his overall skill set at a premium position is what did it for me.
All right. Yeah, Matt.
Well, I was actually going to go with Bogarts as well. I guess both of us against the grain, but I actually put in a word for Brock Holt because he was actually an all-star this year, which is, you know, just so impressive thinking about where he came from and the fact that he played seven positions on the diamond. So, the numbers aren't there with Betts and Bogarts, and they're the two obvious choices, like you said, but he provides so much utility for the team all the way around, and he's probably my third, but I'd say he's a strong guy for consideration. Just like homegrown player of the year, you know, you make an all-star team, that's sort of a nice mark on the resume. So he deserves a look, I think.
That's true. That I had kind of overlooked him. I actually also voted Bogarts, but I'll make the case for Mookie Betts. Betts also played above average defense at a premium defensive position. He hit 15 home runs, which I don't know that we thought we would see out of him this quickly. The average and on-base percentage are a little lower than you might like, but slugging 470 to Bogarts is 419, and he's going to have 20 steals by the end of the year. So I think that's the case for Betts, plus I think saving more runs defensively than Bogarts might have, although I'm not completely positive with that. I think there's an argument for that. All three of those guys, frankly, no real wrong answer there. And I guess rounding out that this three award section is graduate of the year, and graduate of the year is a player who graduated this year. So we just put everyone up there who graduated this season, and the criteria is who do you think will have the best career. So it's kind of like which of the graduates this year will have the best career. The seven graduates this year, and this includes guys who are going to graduate at the end of the year, are, I don't know why they're in this order, and it kind of makes me angry. But, okay, I'll read that this way. Travis Shaw, the first baseman, third baseman, hopefully left fielder down the line. Catcher Blake Swihart, and then five pitchers in Eduardo Rodriguez, Henry Owens, Matt Barnes, Stephen Wright, and Heath Hembree. I think on the one hand, if you're going to vote by who had the best season, and that's the reason we don't do it this way, it would be a pretty obvious choice among these seven guys. But best career, to me, it was a close decision. I went with Blake Swihart for a couple of reasons. First of all, I think it's really hard to choose a pitcher when you're projecting a career. Just because arms are so volatile, can be more injury prone. Although I guess we saw with catchers this year, they can get things like Tommy John as well. So there is that. But to me, Swihart, all he has to be is an above average two-way player to be more valuable at his position than an Eddie Rodriguez or Henry Owens could be at pitcher. Some of the other guys, I think Travis Shaw could make for a very good bench bat, especially if he learns some left field. I think Hembree could be maybe a setup man, but I don't see that necessarily happening. Barnes has to figure out what he is, and Stephen Wright, I think, is a very useful swing man, even though Ian would like to see him banned from baseball. But to me, it was that's why I went Swihart.
That's not true. Come on. That's fair, a little... All right.
I overstated.
For the record, that is not true.
That's not true. Okay, fine. Matt, who did you pick as graduate of the year?
I mean, I'd like to disagree, but Swihart seems like the obvious answer here. Eduardo Rodriguez is obviously in the conversation, but, well, for me at least. I mean,
I was going to say, it's not obvious. He's not winning the voting right now.
Yeah, I guess that's a poor wording choice, but for me, that's the strongest choice for sure. And he's a catcher that's probably the hardest position to develop on the diamond. And Eduardo Rodriguez, he has a chance to be a very very good pitcher, probably, you know, maybe borderline number one, but more like a number two, number three type. And I just think it's so hard to develop catchers, and he looks like he's going to be a pretty good all around catcher. So I that's the definite choice for me.
Mm-hmm. Ian.
I actually also was going to go with Swihart for the reason you mentioned, Chris, the injuries. But the case, I can understand there is a case for Rodriguez. As Matt said, he profiles as, I mean, there's a chance he's a high-end number two starter, I think. And with Swihart, there are still questions. I mean, there are some who are not sure that he's ever going to hit for that much power. And if he's just hitting an empty 280, he's not, you know, he's a very good defensive catcher, but he's not on the level of some of the, you know, the elite game caller defensive catchers we see, like Yadier Molina, Christian Vasquez could be, etc. So if the power doesn't come along for Swihart, he's not, the defense isn't as big a carrying tool as it is for some other catchers. So I think that's that in that situation, if Rodriguez stays healthy and does turn into a high end number two, then he could get the nod there.
Interesting. Interesting. Yep. I like the reasoning for all you get that you guys put out there. Let's move on to comeback player of the year. And this is what it sounds like. This is a comeback player is one who you judge to have most reemerged on the baseball field or as a prospect during the past season. And I note that we also have an award for breakout player of the year, and we keep them separate. Nominees for breakout player of the year are not eligible for comeback player of the year, because otherwise it would just be there's overlap potentially sometimes. Although this year I don't think there really was. I think it was kind of clear two different categories. The nominees at this position were Jackie Bradley, who I think his comeback doesn't really need to be explained. Went from being the worst hitter in the majors last year, pretty much, to a player that now a lot of people see as the future center fielder for this team. Catcher JT Watkins, who basically played in Greenville for half the season. His comeback was from serving in the military for 2 years to being what Ian and I think both agreed was a good organizational catcher and just kind of deserved a mention. Sue Lin, the shortstop for Salem and Portland, he split his season between the two levels, had a pretty good year at the plate, although his final line wound up being only 251, 307, 328, but that was still a significant improvement, and I think his numbers at Salem were a significant improvement on his past hitting numbers. Starting pitcher Ty Buttrey, who went from last year where he was just kind of, you know, Ian had spoken up to what he looked like in Lowell in the past, and he did not have a good year last year in Greenville, to going to Greenville very quickly, showing he was done with the level, and going to Salem and having a little bit of success. Williams Jerez, who we've already discussed, being a guy who came back from being a complete washout as an outfielder, just literally couldn't hit, to being a major league prospect as a relief pitcher, which has been a great comeback for him. And Pat Light, who just wasn't really getting it done as a starter, transitioned into the bullpen this year and was really allowed to, that really allowed him to take off. It's let his fastball play up. Did run into a little bit of rocky waters in AAA after his promotion, but definitely showed some potential to maybe even be a late inning arm in the major leagues. So those are your nominees. Matt, we're on you to go first. Who'd you pick?
Oh, well, Jackie Bradley Jr. was my choice. I mean, that seems like the, you know, looking at the poll, it actually is the obvious choice this time. And, you know, it's hard to choose anyone else. I like the bottom three pitchers for me also took some strong consideration, but each of them sort of had their own flaws, especially Buttrey and Light sort of fell off. I think Harris is a good argument because he was promoted so aggressively, but maybe one of you guys will choose one of those. So for me, it's Jackie Bradley.
Ian.
I disagree. I voted for Williams Jerez, and looking at it, Jackie Bradley definitely improved from what he was last year, but I didn't think last year, I think people overreacted to last year, if that makes sense. His projection for me hasn't changed from what it was last year. Whereas Jerez went from someone who I projected to get cut to someone who now I think could pitch in the big leagues. And for me, that's a much bigger, like, comeback story than just Bradley having a bad year because his hitting mechanics were screwed up versus someone who legitimately
was likely going to be out of baseball and is now in Double A, and, you know, is very likely to be selected. I think is pretty likely to be selected in the Rule 5 draft this year if he's not protected.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. That, you know, it's funny. I voted for Jackie Bradley, and I think you may have just successfully talked me out of it. To me, just the fact that he mentally was able to rebound from being so bad last year in the majors. I think, you know, I don't think he's the hitter that he was when he came back up in the first place, but to me, maybe he's just going to be a hitter who has a lot of hot and cold streaks. But, you know, I think all three pitchers, like Matt alluded to, had Buttrey or Light not tailed off a little bit at the end of the year, I would be more inclined to go with them. I do want to say with Buttrey, you know, I saw him twice. I know he was working on a new curveball. To me, it's just a matter with Buttrey of getting his head in a little better focused spot when he's on the mound. And I think he was able to catch back up to the likes of Trey Ball and Teddy Stankiewicz in that class of pitcher that's coming up through that level of the minors. I think he'll start next year in Portland and, you know, has the chance to kind of pitch his way onto a 40-man roster if he succeeds there. All the physical tools are there. And I think he went, for me, for being a potential non-prospect, even though they gave him all that money, to an example of why you have to give these guys patience. But, you know, Harris is a great story, too. And I, like I said, Pat Light, if he can figure out whatever was bugging him in that in Pawtucket, he's a potential late-inning arm. So maybe one of the three pitchers. I guess makes sense to move to breakout player of the year. This is one, to me, that I think there was a well, maybe there isn't an obvious choice, but a breakout player is one that becomes a significant prospect after previously being considered less than such, or also one who rises from non-prospectdom to vault himself into prospect status. Players in their first pro seasons are not eligible to be breakout players for obvious reasons. Can't really break out if there's no baseline for you. The players nominated this year are, there's five of them, four hitters and a pitcher. There's Luis Alexander Basabe, who's outfielder who spent his year with Lowell. Shortstop Javier Guerra in Greenville. And actually, I should mention, I also tracked down their prospect ranking to start the year and their prospect ranking now as we sit here today. So Basabe jumped from 53 to 23. Javier Guerra jumped from 14 to 7. Shortstop Marco Hernandez, who jumped from 59 to 19. First baseman Sam Travis, who jumped from 17 to 10. And, of course, we already talked about relief pitcher Jonathan Aroh. He jumped from 43 to 28. To me, it's an interesting category at the very least. Ian, who did you pick as breakout player of the year?
I actually voted for someone who no one voted for, incidentally. I went with Luis Alexander Basabe. And here's my reasoning. I disqualified Guerra because I don't think he necessarily was a breakout player, because we kind of saw this at Instructs last year, that this was a guy to watch, and there was a reason we had him in our top 15. Obviously, we didn't have him high enough, but the defensive tools, we had seen them, and we knew what they were, and offensively, I'm still not convinced. I understand he hit 280 with 15 home runs, but I'm still not sold that the 15 home runs are legit. And he doesn't have speed, so he's not going to steal you any bases or anything. And I'm not sold the average is legit either. I think he's probably like a 260, 270 hitter at best. So I kind of think he is what he is, and it's a very good defensive shortstop, but he didn't rise that much for me. And similarly with Hernandez, we had no baseline for him, so I can't really consider a breakout prospect someone who we had no idea what he was, if that makes sense. And I don't think he's much more than a utility guy either, so for same thing, I don't think it's a breakout. And versus Basabe, we saw Basabe last year, and he was just a toolsy guy with a lot of swing and miss in his game. And he showed up in Lowell this year, and obviously he really did tail off at the end of the year, but he showed legitimate tools, both way more power than I ever thought. And I think his power is much more legit than Guerra's. And he's a plus runner, and I think he can play center field. And so I think his tools, kind of, he jumped from someone who was just a lottery ticket to someone who is, I think, is going to be in consideration for my end of the season top 20. And for me, that's a bigger breakout than any of the other guys.
All right, Matt.
I was going to go with Marco Hernandez. I mean, I know we didn't see him ahead of time, but it's not like no scouts. We didn't have any sort of scouting takes on him, but you know, he really rose from sort of almost a non-prospect. I think he fell off our top 60 at one point at the very beginning of the season.
He did.
And then, yeah, and then ended up making it all the way up to 19, basically on, you know, just hitting the ball again and again, and proving that he can hit at the upper levels. And you know, he's sort of known as a pretty solid defensive shortstop. And the hitting, you know, he ended up over 300, 305 between Portland and Pawtucket. So I mean, that was really a surprise for me. So you know, I think, yeah, like I think you mentioned, Garrett is the one that's winning, and in some ways the obvious choice. But for me, it's Marco Hernandez.
Yeah, that's interesting. I see the points you were making, Ian, but I actually went with Javier Guerra, and here's why. I think we knew that the defense was there, the strong defense. That said, I mean, we also know that the strong defense is there for Sue Lin. He's not on a Guerra level, but there's a reason Guerra went from being ranked behind Devin Marrero to being ranked ahead of Devin Marrero, and I think even though it's only by a few spots, I think there's, you know, a mountain between the two. He went out and he hit at a relatively age-advanced level. And even if the power is not going to stick, he's a guy that went from being a very good prospect, player to watch, you know, potential guy down the line, to making good on that potential and becoming a guy who should be a top 100 prospect this offseason. I know of the players we listed, he tied for the least amount of spots jumped in the rankings in the system. But I think that that was climbing over guys who were also doing very well, and it's those were bigger spots to jump to me. So I think he kind of made a leap from being a very good prospect to have in the system to being one, like I said, one of the top 100 prospects in the game probably this off season. You know, I think he may even push top 75s, maybe even higher in some top 100 lists. So,
well, he was top 50 for Keith Law midseason. So
yeah, which did he include draftees? No, or no?
I don't know.
Forget if he includes draftees or not.
I think so he did. Always, I'm pretty sure he did. Yeah, because I remember Brandon Rogers on the list.
Yeah, and I mean, like I said, even if you don't think the 15 home runs are legit, he at least showed that he's got probably doubles pop in the majors, right? I mean, it's not.
Oh no, I think it could be like, you know, 10 to 12.
Yeah, so it, and that's a lot more than we thought he might have had. And, you know, talking to Darren Fenster when we were in Greenville, just talking about how this is a guy who went from never taking a walk to, you know, going up to a major league game and taking a walk, and it was like the news of camp. So, to the point where he was doing better by the end of the year. So, I want to see what he can do next year with moving up to Salem, and to see if he can continue to make good offensively. But to me, that was the biggest leap, even though it wasn't necessarily by number of spots on the chart. Moving on, I guess we should go to our Rookie of the Year. It is what it sounds like. Best first-year player in the system. And frankly, this might be the hardest poll we've ever had. The nominees are outfielder Andrew Benintendi, who was the number 7 overall draft pick, first-round draft pick of the Red Sox. Outfielder Lorenzo Cedrola of the Dominican Summer League. I just talked about him a little bit. I should mention he is, like I said, a center fielder from Venezuela. Red Sox really are hitting Venezuela hard. He's 17 years old. Second baseman Yoan Moncada. Oh, yeah, that guy. Obviously, he's 19, I think, right, from Cuba. I should know how old he is. For some reason, I want to say he's 20, but he's still 19, right? No, he's 20. I'm sorry. He's 20. Yeah, he turned 20 on May 27th. So this was his age 20 season. And then three pitchers in Logan Allen, the 8th-round draft pick, I think, this year, out of IMG Academy in Florida, who pitched in the Gulf Coast League and got one start in Lowell. The Venezuelan lefty Anderson Espinoza, who's 17, pitched in the DSL Gulf Coast League in Greenville. And we've already mentioned the Nicaraguan Roniel Raudez, who pitched in the DSL and Gulf Coast League. Holy crap, gentlemen. Who the heck did you guys pick? I guess is it my turn to start? Crap it is, isn't it? I voted for Yoan Moncada, who I'm surprised right now is in third place in the poll on the board. To me, you know, as far as best season, when you consider everything involved, yes, I know Andrew Benintendi had better stats, for most things, but when you factor in the fact that Moncada had not played in a year and a half, played more of a season at a more age-appropriate level than Benintendi did, it's really hard for me to take Andrew Benintendi's stats in Lowell all that seriously, to be perfectly honest. That he stole 49 bases in 81 games, to me, it was Moncada. I try to tell myself that that's not just because of his prospect status, but you know, I mentioned Benintendi wasn't really at an age-appropriate level, and with Espinoza, I have a hard time really taking the stats from the Gulf Coast League too seriously. We'll talk about that in part two, but you know, Espinoza's numbers in the Gulf Coast League, they play three teams. I think all but one of his starts came against two teams, and those teams weren't very good hitting-wise. And plus, he never had a start longer than four innings, I don't think. I think they tried to let him go longer in Greenville, but he didn't go five innings in that start either. Obviously, unreal statistics. I'm not saying I'm down on him, but to me, I went with Moncada. Matt, who'd you go with?
I mean, like you said, it came down. It was real tough, but I decided on Anderson Espinoza at the end just because it's such a dominant season as a pitcher. And I mean, Ronaldo Raudes is there as well as a pitcher, but it's hard for me to give that much that much credit to the DSL stats. So, I mean, Espinoza really dominated in the GSL and just kept pitching, you know, shutout innings after shutout innings, and is over a much longer period than Logan Allen. And, you know, he was aggressively promoted to Greenville at the end. So I just thought that was such a dominant season from Anderson Espinoza. But Moncada and Benintendi, for my money, were had great seasons as well, and were right there as 1A and or 1B and 1C, I guess.
Yeah.
I wanted to go with Espinoza, but then I looked in the wins category, and he didn't have any wins this year, and that's not, I'm just kidding. I had to do it. No,
yeah, that's kind of, it's kind of hard to get wins when you literally, although it's kind of funny, I should mention this really quick. In the wins statistic, right, the way it's supposed, the definition of it, I believe if the team is planning to not pitch the pitcher for five innings, the scorekeeper can give them a win. It literally never happens, but in theory, he could have gotten wins. Anyway, Ian, go for it.
In all seriousness, I actually went with Andrew Benintendi. And this is kind of going against everything I said about Benintendi in our rankings discussions. But if we're looking at just purely stats and not prospect status or anything, mm-hmm. Benintendi just killed the ball after like a 2-week stretch where he was just trying to hit home runs. He just got on base at an absurd clip. He hit the ball hard all the time, and he showed legit power and speed. And I think that's kind of what separated him from Moncada for me, is I think his on-base skills are better than Moncada's, mm-hmm. and he showed pop, more power than Moncada did. I think Moncada probably long-term has a little more power. But for just this season, Benintendi showed more power in 30 less games or 120 less plate appearances. And that's not an insignificant thing when he hit three more home runs and 120 less plate appearances. Mm-hmm. So I went with him.
Although I do have to say, isolated discipline, Moncada was better than Benintendi, I believe. Looking, eyeballing the numbers. On base percentage minus batting average.
They're like, or almost exactly equal, aren't they?
Oh, they are almost exactly equal. Never mind.
I think Benintendi
sucks. Benintendi's better by 1 point. Never mind.
Higher.
I'll shut up.
My stats are so much more
important. Your maths are better.
But yeah. Use a calculator, bro. That's a free education for you.
Yeah, I mean, Benintendi, if you extrapolate his stats out, that's a 2020 season.
Yeah.
The thing is with Moncada, also, if you extrapolate his stats out, that's a like a 1600 season.
Stolen bases.
Yeah.
But one thing also, I think that I don't know if you guys took this into account, but defensively, Benintendi played a
true
pass. I think he's good at center field. He's not not the Jackie Bradley, Manuel Marco level center fielder, but I think he could be a solid average center fielder versus Moncada. I mean, I understand that there were reports, I mean, that people who saw him for a game or two thought he saw some good signs defensively. And I mean, we saw them too, Chris. But over a four-game stretch, he still just – he booted way too many routine balls for my liking. And he just – defensively, I'm not sold on him at second base yet.
It's signs, right? I mean, it's
– He has all the tools, and he'll show flashes in game. It's just improving consistency versus Benintendi just goes out there every day and plays a good center field.
Right.
And for this year, I think maybe long-term, I don't have questions about Moncada defensively long-term aren't that great. But for this year, there are questions, and Benintendi, there were no questions with him. He can play center field.
Got it. All right, well, let's move on. Two awards left. First off is our pitcher of the year. The nominees, we've talked about literally all of these guys, so I'll just go through them very quickly. Relief pitcher Jonathan Aroh, starting pitcher Anderson Espinoza, starting pitcher Brian Johnson, starting pitcher Henry Owens, starting pitcher Roniel Raudes, and swingman, I guess, he spent half the year as like a piggyback starter and half the year as a starter, Aaron Wilkerson. I believe we're on Matt. Matt, who did you pick as the pitcher of the year?
Well, I talked about him earlier, and I actually went with Aaron Wilkerson just because of the – I mean, Anderson Espinoza had the flashier stat line. I already mentioned him earlier, but, you know, he had – Wilkerson had, you know, by far more than double the amount of innings pitched. And I would say – I don't have it in front of me, but I would think he pitched probably one of the most innings in the system. And, you know, all the numbers are sort of there. The whip for that amount of innings is you know, super low, and the more strikeouts than 107. Sorry, 137 strikeouts in 136 and two-thirds innings. So you know, great numbers there as well. Obviously, he's a little old for his level, but not taking that into consideration, I think he had the best season of the bunch.
And I'll just throw out there, Wilkerson actually was sixth in the system in innings. The leader was Jalen Beeks, actually, with 145.2. Wilkerson was nine innings behind him. But that said, the fact that Wilkerson he made 29 appearances, and I don't have the number in front of me, but I want to say at least 10 of them were in relief. So the fact that he got that many, having to piggyback, you know, you would think if he was starting the whole year, he probably would have been up there. The other thing I should mention, Wilkerson tied with Kevin McAvoy and William Cuevas for the system lead in wins, which we know Ian cares about a lot, with 11 wins. So, Ian, obviously I'm assuming you picked Aaron Wilkerson because of all those wins, right?
Yeah, I love a good win. I went with Brian Johnson, actually.
Okay.
And he put up similar numbers to Wilkerson, but he did it all in Pawtucket versus Wilkerson was a 25 or 26-year-old pitching in Salem and Portland. And that was the big separator for me, was just Johnson was doing it at the highest level possible in the minors versus Wilkerson was doing it lower down. So,
And yeah. We should mention that Wilkerson is, in fact, a year and a half older than Johnson. So, adding that to what you said, Ian.
Yeah. So that was my main reasoning, was just the level difference. And it was similar numbers at a much higher level. Or not a much higher level, but a higher level.
I am going to make the case for the most dominant pitcher in the system this year, and that's Anderson Espinoza. Frankly, the guy can pitch in the games he is put into, and that's all he can do. Espinoza was in the system all year. Yes, he went to short season, but he was by far the most dominant force in the system. It doesn't even really get borne out in the numbers. Yes, he struck out 65 batters and only walked 14 in 58 and a third innings. He had an ERA of 1.23, and I think that was only that high because of the start in Greenville that he had. But the thing to me that's most impressive is that if you take pitch, how many innings do you have? 50 something? Okay. So with pitchers with at least 40 innings pitched, if you go to the ground ball to fly ball ratio that you can get on the Sox prospect stat page, he was nearly, well, I don't really, it's a ratio, so I don't know how much more this is, but his ground ball to fly ball ratio was 4.57. And again, this is for starters with at least 40 innings pitched. the next ratio, again, it was 4.57, so that's 4.5 ground balls to every ball hit in the air. The next up was Kevin McAvoy at 2.87. So, again, it's factors of whatever, but the difference from 2.87 to 4.57 is just light years. He was absolutely dominant. And like I said, I would love to see what his numbers look like, minus that one Greenville start where he was, again, he was 13 months younger than the next youngest player in the South Atlantic League. Again, I guess I just wanted to make the case for Anderson Espinoza, who I think would be a deserving pitcher of the year. He's leading the voting right now. I voted for Johnson, but wanted to make that argument. And that leaves one
it's
award
funny
off.
I voted for Espinoza.
Did you?
Yeah.
Fair enough.
We should edit that out. Sounds like we didn't do that, but
whatever. No, it's fine. I don't care. People say we don't disagree enough, so we're trying to disagree.
No, so that was the first one where I actually changed my answer to.
Really?
Interesting. No, I lied, but.
Yeah, okay. Anyway, offensive player of the year. Offensive player of the year. Again, these are all guys we've talked about, although I don't think we've talked about one of them yet. But the nominees for offensive player of the year are Andrew Benintendi, Jackie Bradley, Rafael Devers, Javier Guerra, Yoan Moncada, and Sam Travis. So basically, it's Benintendi, Bradley, Travis, and the Greenville infield. Ian, it's your turn to start. Who did you vote for as offensive player of the year?
I actually voted for Yoan Moncada, which went against what I voted for what was the other one, rookie of the year or something?
Yes.
And my logic with this was I took defense out of it, and taking defense out of it.
You took defense out of offensive player of the year?
I did. And, well, no, that sounded really dumb, actually.
No, it's fine. But don't worry about it.
I value defense a lot, a decent amount when I was thinking about the rookie of the year. Mm-hmm. And when you take that out, Benintendi, as you mentioned, I think in the rookie of the year discussion, Benintendi was doing what he should have at that level as the number 7 overall pick, versus Moncada was coming off of not having played baseball or faced live pitching in, I think, 18 months. And yes, he got off to a slow start, but once he got going, I don't know if you have the second half numbers, or I think it's the post All-Star break numbers, but he had something like 45 steals in 50 games in the second half, 6 of his home runs, I want to say. He crushed the ball, and he showed power, speed, on base ability, just the total package was there. So just strictly offense, he got for me. And he's 19 for. Benintendi's 21, I want to say. 20? He's a little older.
He's 21 because he was draft eligible because he turned 21.
Correct. And yeah, and Benintendi put up part of his numbers in Lowell, which he, to be fair, shouldn't have really started there in the first place, I don't think. So, yeah, Moncada for me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. I'm just trying to pull up his splits. Post All-Star in 56 games, 310, 415, 500. 7 home runs, 56 games, stole 45 bases, and was caught 3 times.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's good.
That's good. That's very good. Matt, who did you have as the offensive player of the year?
Well, I actually had Moncada as well, and the steals are really the difference for me. But the guy I kind of want to point out besides that is Sam Travis. I think... Sorry, but I think, you know, I think he's really deserving with especially, you know, Moncada only played in 81 games, and Sam Travis really played in a huge slate for the minors in 131 games, and maintained that high batting average of .307, and, you know, you just like to see the power develop a little more from him as a first baseman.
Yeah, I actually voted for, or I should say I would vote for Sam Travis as well. To me, it came down to if you look at performance over the span of the entire season, on the one hand, yes, you can only play in the games that, you know, you are put into the starting lineup for, or that you're even in the system for, in the case of Andrew Benintendi or Yoan Moncada, for example. But there's a statistic on our stats page called Runs Created, and it's one way to kind of try and show a player's offensive output accumulated over the course of a given span of time. And Travis led the system with 83.1 runs created this season. And the second place hitter in the Red Sox system for the year was Marco Hernandez, who was probably the last one out before, as my cat has decided to come say hello. Marco Hernandez was probably the last one out of the poll, and he's second at 68.4 for the season. If you use the statistic runs created per 27 outs, which tries to approximate what a lineup full of, say, that player performing the way he has over the course of the season would perform, how many runs they would that lineup would produce over the course of a game, it is Benintendi by a long shot. He had 9.5 runs created per 27 outs. Second place was a bunch of guys at 7 in the sevens. So to me, it was between them, but I would go with Travis just because he had his output for a much longer period of time, more than double the plate appearances that Andrew Benintendi had. But I do think it's pretty close. All right, so that wraps up the awards that are up for voting. The one thing that I wanted to ask you guys real quick, and I'm putting you on the spot here, if there were a Defensive Player of the Year award, who would you pick? I think it might be unanimous, but I guess it's my turn to go first. So I would say Javier Guerra. Do you guys have different picks for Defensive Player of the Year?
I mean, I think I would say I'm going to go Manuel Margot, actually. And mainly because Guerra's plays a harder position, but he still, I don't know how many errors he made on the year. And
that's
I don't
fair.
Really.
That's fair. I'll look it up.
I honestly don't really care how many errors he made, but I just, having seen him, he still has some, he's still a little sloppy and kind of he'll boot the routine play here and there, or he'll make a great play, but then he'll get a little sloppy on the footwork. Versus Margot's, he's very consistent out there. And every time I've seen him, it's very good. And his range, it's not Jackie Bradley-esque, but it's pretty darn close. So I'll go with him.
All right. That's interesting. I've got it. It's 27 errors, by the way, for Guerra.
Yeah.
So his fielding percentage, which is meaningless, is only 954. Whereas Margot, I'll look
is it 954 good, though? I have no idea what a good shortstop fielding percentage is, to be honest. But
yeah, maybe it is good. That's a good point. I guess I don't know either.
I have no.
Marco, on the other hand, that's the Dominican Winter League. Had 5 errors this year. So
no,
his fielding percentage was 984. That said, for an outfielder, it's much different.
Yeah, I would have gone with Guerra if you hadn't gone with him.
But I think one thing I didn't realize is that Margot did play one game in right field this year. That's interesting.
That is interesting because he doesn't have the greatest arm. So versus Bradley, you can very easily project him as a right fielder with his arm. But yeah, that's interesting.
Matt, did you come up with anybody? Or
well, just taking a different direction, something out of off the wall is Rafael Devers, just because he wouldn't actually win, but just because we heard compared to maybe sort of the most improved defensive player of the year, we heard reports about how he was destined for first base, and then Ian and reports back from the Greenville team, you as well, Chris, saw him several times and really liked what you saw defensively. So that was sort of the biggest sort of mover for me. And then I don't know, another name is Jeremy Rivera. I know I saw him a couple times, and Ian really liked what he saw defensively. So he's smooth at short. So he's an up and comer for future Defensive Player of the Year, maybe.
That's a good call, Rivera. I like that one actually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just throwing out some names that might have been on the short list. Nick Longhi at first base, perhaps. He's very good at first.
Travis also.
Sam Travis, yep. Sue Lin at short. Where's some other guys? Jordan Procession at catcher. I think that's about maybe should mention Marco Hernandez at short.
No.
Not quite on that level, so
no.
Maybe not.
Bro, Bradley, right?
Oh, I guess Bradley was maybe he would have won.
I thought about it, but I didn't consider him because of He played 71 games at Pawtucket. Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah,
probably should have been a major leaguer.
I just think of him as a major leaguer. But
yeah, probably should have been him. And then Brian Johnson for pitcher defense. He's a very good defensive pitcher. So, yeah, just thought that was something I should throw out there. Well, we've already gone on far too long here in part one of our season wrap-up. We were going to record part two immediately after this, but that's not happening. So we will get back on the horn soon to record part two. So if you've got email questions, send them in, podcast@soxprospects.com. We thank you all for downloading. Thank you for listening. enjoy the final 2 weeks of MLB's regular season. Thank you to these guys for hopping on. Thank you to my new cat for not meowing at all during the podcast, which I didn't think was going to happen. Thank you all for listening. Like I said, again, we'll be back in your eardrums very soon. Thanks, everybody. Thank you.